This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
On mining mind, and a little bit about our practice in doing that. But first, we usually go around and introduce ourselves with our name, and maybe a word or two about your mind.
Mike, no mind. Never mind.
Michael. Mike stole my answer.
I'm Leland. I have a lot of stress in my life.
Ross, I guess I'm trying to learn the relationship of the mind to the rest of my experience.
Karen, noticing my mind.
Yeah, just started meditating and learning what it's all about.
Judy?
Slightly cloudy with a chance of storms.
Catherine, practicing self-acceptance.
Zhen Shen, Shen. No mind.
David, peace of mind.
Tom, peaceful 88-year-old mind.
Ellen, slightly sleepy.
Jason, always curious about the world.
Andy, busy mind.
Trying to settle mind.
Nico, racing mind.
Phil, trying to bring calm to my mind.
Ronnie, mind is light.
Reese, curious mind.
Azim, trying to observe my mind.
Marie, storm clouds, gentle rain.
Anna, my mind is just crazy. And I try to learn how to control mine.
Mel, okay, mind.
Wow. Great, great, great diversity of minds. So I wanted to talk first about Zazen and its relation to mind, and particularly as expressed in this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And it's words and stories primarily from Zen Center of San Francisco, Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, one of our teachers, mentors. And most of the stories that I know are from and through San Francisco Zen Center. But I will say that the examples that I follow are more from Jikoji and Jikoji's teachers. So keep that in mind. And Zazen, right practice. What we practice in sitting here now, what we're doing, is primarily posture, first and most important, trying to maintain a stretched, straight spine. And also breathing, attention to breathing. So our awareness comes back to, returns to our breathing whenever our mind drifts. control. We have a wide, spacious mind, wide open, big mind, if you will. But there are some limits. So we place some limits on ourselves in this practice, keeping our posture, keeping our attention to breathing as part of our practice. We experience waves in our mind of thoughts drifting, and weeds in our mind, things that we really think we wish we didn't have. But again, going back to control, we return to awareness of our breathing from time to time. And the marrow of our practice is that, always returning to awareness. The basic practice of just returning to our breath, maybe once or twice during a period, straightening our posture, trying to maintain an erect posture as well as an alert mind. Incidentally, my volume tends to go down the more I speak, so if you can't hear me, do something like this or wave, because it will help me. Non-duality is another part of the practice, which is a little bit more difficult, but it's basically if you're practicing, there's a problem because there's a person who's practicing and then there's a thing that the person is doing. So a duality. And the practice is to continue practicing until that duality fades into something like a subtle feeling of just sitting. Bowing is also important. So we've had our bowing ceremony, practice of acknowledging publicly that we're not really responsible for all this. We have access, but it's nothing special. It's just a practice of returning to our awareness, returning to posture, returning to our attention. So all that long sentence is essentially the first section of this book, Right Practice. You have it in a nutshell in just a few minutes. No special feeling associated with it. There's no need to attain anything. There's other practices that many of us have. Many of us are Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or Hebrew or Muslim, or we have our own. And all those welcome their practitioners within us, within our practice. So you're welcome to do your own practice and to have your own beliefs and values and whatever. The Zazen practice is just to sit and have confidence in the sitting that if we do this long enough, we'll see. Kōpen Rōshi said, Kōpen is the founder of this temple and our first course teacher for many of us, said, one must disappear in the sitting. There is no other way. So that subtle feeling leads to the personal self disappearing, just practicing over time. Suzuki Roshi in this book said, there is, when we sit, we are nothing. We just sit. We don't even realize what we are. But when we get up we create everything. When we get up, we create everything, and we are back to our ordinary, egocentric, day-to-day, relational minds. There is a question of what the mind really is. We talked about Zen mind so far, beginner's mind, no mind, almost every kind of mind you can think of. So there are many, many different aspects of mind. One of my personal theories, and it may not be validated, is that whenever there's a mind, there's a self, or there's an ownership. There's something, there's a subject-object relationship. So that's part of the thing that we practice about. We may bask in things like silent illumination, as described by Hongji, or pure awareness, particularly in sashins, feelings of purity, reaching the source, realizing truth. But we can't really do that through our senses or through our intellect. It's only through our being that realization is possible. And even then, as this particular koan that I want to go through demonstrates, is something that requires some additional practice. Well, the koan is the ordinary mind koan. Zhao Shu asked Nan Quan, "What is the way?" Nan Quan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." Zhao Shu, also known as Joshu, in Japanese, and Nansen, was his teacher. He'd come as a young man and had been practicing at the monastery for 3 years, and he finally asked his teacher, "What is the way? What are we practicing? What is to do? What's this all about?" And his teacher's answer was, "Ordinary mind is the way." Joshu asked, "Should I turn toward it or not?" Nansen said, "If you turn toward it, you turn away from it." Zhao Zhu asked, "How do I know the way if I don't turn toward it?" Nansen said, "The way is not about knowing and not knowing. When we know something, we are deluded. When you don't know, you are blank. When you reach the way beyond doubt, it is as vast and infinite as space. You can't say it's right or wrong." With these words, Joshu had some realization, at least according to the koan. I would be a little bit heretical in looking at the koan and saying, does it really consistent? Ordinary mind is the way, as vast and infinite as outer space. You can't say it's right or wrong. So that's one of the puzzles in our practice. Some other quick koans, quick notes on mind as part of a koan. Diamond Sutra, out of nowhere the mind comes forth. Without the mind, there is no Buddha. Without the Buddha, there is no mind. That was Bodhidharma. A student asked, "What is Satori?" The master said, "It is the original mind." The pupil asked, "What is the original mind?" The master responded, "Not one thing." The student asked again, "What is not one thing?" The master shut up. So one final one that I'll read in honor of our maintenance manager, Hogan, who's not here. It's Hogan, a Chinese Zen teacher, lived alone in a small temple in the country. One day, four traveling monks appeared and asked if they might make a fire in his yard to warm themselves. While they were building the fire, Hogan heard them arguing about subjectivity and objectivity. He joined them and said, "There's a big stone. Do you consider it to be inside or outside of your mind?" One of the monks replied, "From the Buddhist viewpoint, everything is an objectification of mind, so I would say that the stone is inside my mind." Hogan replied, "Your mind must feel very heavy." If you were carrying around a stone like that all the time. So in talking about mining mind, I really have in mind the semantics of mining as being mine. Any time I try to get into it, I'm grasping, I'm creating a subject who's trying to do something to the object. And that mine may be the source of most of our suffering. We have kind of a TERF, emotional reaction to almost everything. And at core, this is the product of evolution. When you're really alarmed, you freeze, you flee, or you fight. That's the basic things that your brain is evolutionarily designed to do. And as we get more sophisticated, we mitigate that because of our practice. There's also many habits that contribute to that. But sometimes going to the habits makes your reactions actually worse rather than better. There's a lot of psychological studies recently that go into the no-mind aspect of Buddhism, the no-self in particular, no single self. You have many selves. You have a biological self, you have your body, your skin bag, you have your relational self, your social self, your emotional self. Each of these has a self and a set of ownership associated with it. So it's kind of a TERF. And when our TERF is threatened, we generally try to react in some way. So it's very instinctual and very deeply grounded. The psychological studies also describe the mind, our minds, individual minds, as modular, not a single controller, not a single owner, not a single container, but instead many different modules of mind, a little bit like competing animals within us. One of the popular Buddhist teachings is that those animals include a wolf who's out voraciously to devour whatever it can consume, and maybe a mother, a loving part of the mind, and that the choice of which of those two modules we get in any given situation is a function of our practice. So we may react aggressively and trying to get whatever we can out of the situation, out of the person, out of the interaction. Or we may react with loving kindness and consideration and compassion and humility as warranted. But the modules of the mind are pretty well established, I think, now. And even science is no single CEO in your mind. There's no little being inside that's really calling the shots and making the decisions. In fact, decisions now are pretty clearly understood to be mostly emotional. You can reason all you want, but then when you get down to pulling it all together, it's the emotion that counts. So you have both feelings and emotions to deal with, and thoughts. Body senses, sensations and impressions. Three of the four foundations of mindfulness. The fourth is dharma, or change, time. Awareness of those are the four foundations of mindfulness. I wanted to mention also along this line that the particular finding that I love was from an economist who made a lot of studies on how people make decisions, Daniel Kahneman. And he basically established there's two thinking modes in his oversimplifications of humans. It's, he won the Nobel Prize, so pretty well accepted. And thinking modes are fast and slow. The fast is the emotional immediate response. The slow is the slightly mitigated rational thinking response. So we have two selves, one in the immediate emotional, probably closer to the brain stem, closer to our roots in evolution, and the other, what we'd like to see in our leaders, a little bit of reason mitigating the decision. But one final point on ownership. Maybe it's final, I don't know. Kōben Roshi said something in one of his books that I thought was remarkable, and it's like many things that he said that were off just his immediate feeling, and but still made a big impression on me. And it was, nothing belongs to me, not even my body. So there are lots of problems in talking to you, I'm aware of, and I usually cite the fact that words lie intrinsically, they contradict themselves. Stories mislead in that they focus, you find it, you get the meaning, and you miss the context. Yet, even so, there's, in contrasting our minds, I like also Thich Nhat Hanh's idea that there are really three realities. One is the physical, evolutional, quantum physical-based reality. Another is the human imagination. And the third is the laws, causes and conditions, or dharma, or physical laws, if you prefer. The human imagination, in a sense, dwarfs reality. And it may not be just human. We suspect that it's part of any feeling, thinking, being with consciousness. But it is it can create many, many, many universes, as you know, and you can fall into any one of them with any module. There are also hindrances that we talk about in Buddhism, and they're all related to this concept of ownership. There's the hindrance of grasping, trying to get everything you can, the wolf, if you will, and pushing away aversion, trying to say, this is not me. All those are a little bit different from our practice, which is just to see things as they are and to let them go as they go. There are also many shadows in any self. There are shadows of psychological problems, of personal desires, of your upbringing when you were a child, your parents' problems, and all the way back through the evolution that we've mentioned. In Buddhist literature, we call this, I think, the alaya, the subconscious mind. Many of the things that we talk about are part of the subconscious mind, certainly the history, the memory, the habits, the indulgences and the merit, good acts, virtues. Most of those are unconscious by the time they surface. The motivation is surfaced, but they surface through this emotional decision-making, acting process. So to get back to the teachings, one of the things that Suzuki Roshi said is that at some point in training, in getting into this practice, one could do with a general housekeeping of the mind, taking things out, cleaning them, looking at them, being aware of them. He's talking about beliefs, maybe ideals, maybe convictions. One of the problems he had was that many of the students were young hippies, and they were really into love. Love conquers everything. Love is the end of, let's practice love. I'd like to practice out that we could practice peace. I would like to be peaceful. There are many other ideals that we can practice in a similar vein. Thich Nhat Hanh said something like, peace is everywhere, within us and all around us, in our body, in our minds, in the universe. Touching on it, we can be healed and transformed. It is not a matter of theory, it's a matter of practice. So just doing it repeatedly, and like the fog that Suzuki Roshi talks about, it eventually soaks into you through practice. We do all have our own individual, as much as we have individual ideas of what our mind is, and we focus on one aspect of mind almost immediately. In Zazen, big mind is the mind to keep in mind, to open to. My practice is to breathe in, open, breathe out, let it go, let whatever was doing that go. That's kind of a naive practice, but if I include the self and the ownership, the thing that's making up a self that's doing that at the same time, it works for me. So I see from slightly glazed eyes that I'm maybe going on too much, covering too much ground quickly. But wanted to mention that the at least one comment on mind is a soft, open, receptive, reflective, responsive, kind, loving mind, etc. is what we're we have to begin with, actually, and what we try to develop, bring forward through this practice. The final poem, Rumi said something like, there's a garden beyond good and bad, beyond right and wrong. Meet me there. I have no idea what time it is, or
time for questions.
Okay. My hearing is such that I really can't hear many people, so I will look to my sidekicks riding shotgun on this to answer questions that I really can't understand, and most questions I really can't understand because you have too much background. But go ahead. Any questions or comments? Andy.
Hey, Cliff. Thanks for the talk. Thanks for the mind-provoking talk. My question is, you're talking about the alaya, and you're using the language of the subconscious or the unconscious, which perhaps is a psychoanalytic term. I'm wondering if there's another way to discuss it in context with what you're saying. So I found my mind going into a kind of psychoanalytic framework, and then I was like, well, is that what it is? Is there a crossover? You know what I mean? There's something that wasn't quite clear to me in the context that you were using, that you were addressing the alaya or the storehouse consciousness.
I think I understood that, and I would say yes, indeed, exactly.
Just a question as a beginner. Notice my legs fall asleep. Does it get easier over time, or do the sitting, the physical aspects, the nature of the pain, does that seem to subside over? Or the more you sit, the better it gets? or not, I don't know.
Please forgive a long personal answer, but it took me fully 5 years before I actually got into the full lotus, and that was of consistent practice and sesshins and the like. It took me another 20 years before I got into the full lotus through a full sashin, and I can't do it now. And I cheat when my leg goes to sleep, which almost always happens, my left leg. I either bend like this for about almost a full minute, or I lift myself off the cushion. So yes, if there's really something wrong with the posture and it's part of your physiology or part, just general, it's painful. There's no point in trying to continue to have a stiff upper lip. There are a lot of tough guys in this practice, and I'm not one of them, so.
More in the smart guy category.
Sorry?
More in the smart guy category.
What do they call that these days? The techie?
Can I say something?
Yes, please.
He is one of the tough guys in this practice. just not up to his own standards, but it's okay to relax and come back to it and sit with what works and work gradually towards it. Sorry, I just had to point that out. it doesn't have to be painful.
And the cushion really matters. Like, I remember doing a sashin, and first 2 days were horrible, and then I tried a bunch of cushions, and with one, it was perfect.
Okay, good to know. Thank you. Question.
What should I do if I feel sleepy when I do meditation? Should I stop or just let it sleep? Let sleepy?
Do you meditate with your eyes closed?
No, just feel very tired and sleepy when I face the wall.
Stretch your eyes. Make them big.
Okay.
And that's one recommendation. Another recommendation is you tighten up your posture a little bit, make your posture a little stronger, kind of more upright. And another good antidote for sleepiness is you bring your attention to your inhalation. So, like as Chris said, with your exhalation you're kind of released, but with your inhalation you can kind of get energy, get vitalized, and so you pay particular attention to taking in a breath, and it'll kind of wake you up and make your meditation a little brighter, hopefully. Everybody gets sleepy when they meditate. Sometimes, though, people get the opposite. They get too excited or too tense, so then they have to balance that as well.
Perhaps more of a comment question, but I was listening to something about the history of cheese making, and it occurred to me that meditation is a little like that, that you know, you can have the ideas, but it's only through, like, somebody had to figure it out, and you can only do it yourself. You know, it's like, I have to figure out how to make cheese, and I have to keep trying and keep, you know, it's not going to happen by not doing it. And I may, you know, every time I try it, it may or may not work, but it's like some combination of getting some insight from others, but also I have to figure out how to make cheese. And it's paying attention to the what's going on. And yeah, so it seems, I mean, I still don't know how to meditate.
Thank you. That's good. There's the whole practice of Zen, also called the Dharma Gate of Ease and Joy. So if you want an easy, joyful way to get into the practice, that's it. But Dogen, one of our teachers 1,200 years ago, likened it, I believe, to, I don't remember if that's right context or not. Anyway, there are many teachers who've commented on that too, likened to baking bread. You have to be aware, study yourself. That was what I was thinking of. To study yourself, you practice the way is to study yourself. To study the self is to eventually forget the self in the process.
I have two unrelated questions. One, why face the wall? Two, when you have a lot of strong energy flows and if you want to shake, can you comment on that?
The latter one is easier. In Tassajara, there was some lady who sat just across from me, opposite side of a little low barrier. She would shake, rattle, and roll through the hole, and she had been there for several years. And I mean, she would bounce on her zafu during zazen. And the teachers then encouraged her practice, encouraged her to continue. And I think that was her success, was being able to do that until it was no longer happening. The first one was?
Why face the wall?
Oh, the senior teacher. We do that because our teachers, but.
Colvin said that facing the wall is like going into an alley, a blind alley.
Mm.
It's a dead end. It's so basically sitting facing the wall is like coming to a place where you have to stop. And of course, practically, it's to reduce our sensory input that we don't have a lot of, we're very visual and we don't have a lot of visual information.
Mm-hmm.
But he saw it more that we have to, it's actually an acknowledgement that we're willing to stop making a self, stop,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
stop the the, what did you say, the ownership of the mind, it's mine, all this is mine, yeah, you've stopped that.
Mm-hmm. Just to add to that, there's a talk, TED talk by Brother David, who's a mentor of this, close friend of Koban's and mentor of this practice, who had 5 million hits or more. So it's up in the stellar realm for the TED talks, and it was basically on the practice of stop, look, go. Citing back to the primary child crossing the street as a basic training. So that's his talk on...
I think, too, that we have this word shamatha, which means to settle, to place the mm-hmm. mind,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the ways of describing meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that the Chinese character for it basically means stop. Just stop it.
mm-hmm. And does vipassana mean insight, basically? Is that synonymous, or is shamatha?
Yeah, precise seeing.
Yeah.
Shamatha, vipassana, two wings.
Mm-hmm.
What are the reasons that we keep our eyes half open as opposed to closed?
I didn't pick that up, John.
Why do we keep our eyes half open rather than closed? Or open?
I think simply to stay awake, to be aware of what's happening around you, to include that, what it's in your big mind awareness. More?
There are meditation forms that where your eyes are closed. In Vipassana, they're closed. So I think both are okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have some eye strain or anything, or it's difficult for you to keep your eyes open, you can close them. But if you get sleepy or spacey or dreamy, then it's good to open your eyes and even make them bright if you get sleepy. And I think, as Cliff said, it's just to not shut down your sensory sense. So we, in the midst of being aware of our body and mind, we're aware of hearing, we're seeing, and we're sensing and everything. So we're not constricting that in practice so much. We're just letting it be, and just being present.
What's a moment that you sure or you believe the Buddha's teaching is true, is not false one? So do you have the moment that you really believe that all the Buddha's teaching is true? And what can you share the experience of that moment?
Please.
We don't know. Satan not knowing is most intimate. We know the teaching is true when we're comfortable with the not knowing. When the not knowing gives us freedom, that there's no need to know. But then Laurie Anderson, who's a performance artist I was listening to once, and she said this story when you hear it. Whether it happened or not, it's true. That's when you know.
Well, I will mention that there's scheduled little commercial, a discussion of brain and mind as part of a science and Buddhism series of discussions, and that'll happen at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And there's some idea that it's grounded in at least awareness of what all the quantitative sciences have to say, so more in terms of the neural contributions to our problems. And I'd love it if you really want to talk a little bit more about mind. I think my particular interest this afternoon is try to say, how is this possible? You know, there are different pictures of what is mind. And I look at the leaves outside and I see a million details. But I'm told by science that what's happening is that photons are flowing through eyes and through receptors, cones and rods and nerves, optic nerves, millions of fibers, and a few billion neurons get involved in telling me what that is. But there are other aspects of science, other scientists actually working on the possibility that mind is embedded in something that we might consider universal, that there's a proto-consciousness as part of the quantum reality, universe. Then the question becomes, for each of us, how do we see it? So I'd hope to at least try that on. What is real? Is mind a reality? I think you have to admit some reality.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.